by the middle of the 20th century, photography had well and truly made the shift from utility to a form of art in itself, complementing more traditional genres. Just one more step in the continuous journey of art and artistic expression. Then in 1957, a guy named Russell Kirsch, a computer scientist in the United States, developed the first digital image scanner. Like early photographs, the first digital images were pretty basic things, more proof of concept than proof of artistic creativity. But lo and behold, the scanner and other digital technologies that followed soon opened up a whole new avenue for artists. And now, if you hang around in the right circles, you're possibly just as likely to hear someone use the phrase post-internet art as you are to hear them musing on about early 20th century modernism or abstract expressionism. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to Future Tense.
Hi, I'm Angelo Satira. I'm the co-founder and CEO of DeviantArt, a platform that I've been running for the past 16 years. We serve the creative community by providing a global platform where artists can be nurtured through their creative journey.
Angelo Satira from DeviantArt, which, by the way, despite what might first come to mind, is a site that's safe for work. So you can check it out while we continue with the program. We'll hear from Angelo again shortly. The theme for this show is art and the connected future. And our first guest is Ben Davis. He's a New York-based art critic and author who writes for the site ArtNet News. Now, when Ben Davis looks ahead, he sees art in the future splitting into two. So I began this interview by asking him to explain the two dimensions of art he sees developing.
Well, I mean, I review museum and gallery art. So for me, the question is really, what do we expect the museum to look like in the future? And I think it is a time of tremendous strain and stress for artists who work within that space because of technological change, because there's such a competition for attention at greater and greater scales. Then you have people working in the tradition of the museum in painting and sculpture and in more adventurous media, but they have to fight for attention in that space. So I think you see two directions developing. One is more and more spectacular turn in the museum, where art looks more and more sort of like theme parks for adults, very spectacular interactive environments that are crowd-pleasing and interesting, but you don't necessarily need to know anything about art, art history, in order to engage with that kind of contemporary art. That's one direction that museums are taking in the United States, where I work, and around the world. And then this is a little more speculative, but I see sort of in a similar way to how there's a lot of talk about the culture of mindfulness and meditation. And it's so clearly this reaction to feeling overwired and looking for space in a world where you're bombarded by information. So I do think there's a place for museums in the future as sort of the very fact that they house this old kind of culture, you know, that comes from a different time period, was built with a different rhythm in mind. I think it's possible that that becomes a virtue in this sort of world we live in, and that art makes a virtue of its silence, you know? I think that's more speculative, you know? That's me speculating on what art's strengths really are within this world, this changing media world. But it's a hypothesis about the future that I have.
The first conception of art that you see, that idea of it becoming much more, you know, theme park style, I suppose, networked and immersive, when it gets to that stage, though, will we still think of it as art? Do we still think of it as art? I mean, what qualities does it have to retain in order for it to be art and not just entertainment or an experience?
I think that's a big question. I mean, I think it's a dangerous road for art to go down. The name of my talk is Digital Art in Danger, you know, because I have that very question. And there, for instance, in the United States, there have been certain art shows that have been extremely popular, that, you know, with lines around the block to small art galleries here in Chelsea, works by James Turrell or Doug Wheeler, which are essentially kinds of highbrow art light shows where you walk into environments and experience yourself immersed in light and experience very subtle gradations of light, and it plays with your perception in a quite marvelous way. Or Yayoi Kusama, the Japanese artist, makes these really immersive environments that are mirrored landscapes that are wondrous to be in and also great for taking selfies in. And those are quite crowd-pleasing, but at the end of last year, this scented candle company here in New York opened something they called the Museum of Feelings, which was an installation in Lower Manhattan that was an immersive installation that essentially ripped off elements of all of these artists, these kind of interactive environment artists, and turned them into a walkthrough maze where you went through different light shows and interactive experiences. And it all led up to stations where you could post images of yourself, selfies from the environment, and buy custom scented candles. And there was no name of an artist attached to it at all. You know, it was just, it was by something called Radical Media, but it was hugely popular. So once art starts playing on that level, I think it is an open question, you know, whether it's sort of talking itself out of a job. Do you, if what you're offering people is really just the equivalent of a highbrow theme park, it might be that there's not much of a future for the museum as the kind of institution we know now at all.
And of course, you can have an immersive experience, or you can have any, you know, any kind of artistic experience online without the need to even go near an institution like a gallery or museum, can't you? I mean, we're now seeing people being enormously creative on platforms like Instagram and Tumblr.
Yeah, and that's new territory. I have written a lot about the way artists are relating to and can relate to those kinds of platforms. And one of the things that strikes me about Instagram, for instance, or Tumblr, or the kind of creativity you see on Pinterest or sites like this, is that if you go back to the 70s, a lot of people will be familiar with the great BBC program, Ways of Seeing, by the British art critic John Berger, where he talks about what he optimistic ways that he thinks that mass media might revolutionize the museum to make it a less elitist, more populist experience. And when he talks about what the ideal future might look like, he says, well, imagine forms of media where anybody could contribute artworks, or you could take images and arrange them according to your own personal associations and make them part of your life instead of taking this story that's handed down from tradition. And what he's describing as this kind of utopian program really sounds exactly like what everyone has in their pocket today. So there's a kind of a sense in which, yeah, those kinds of platforms on the one hand realize this dream that make a certain kind of aesthetic experience much more accessible to people. But at the same time, what that leaves for museums and the kind of expectations that it raises in an audience, you know, I think a lot of museum professionals, artists are wrestling with these things. And I actually think that a lot of the interesting thinking about art will come out of wrestling with those kinds of questions.
Setting the scene there, New York art critic and author Ben Davis. Let's now pick up on those themes around the nature of digital art and the role of the gallery in the digital age with Dr. Kathy Cleland, the director of the Digital Cultures Program at the University of Sydney.
I think it's very hard to make a blanket comment about digital art. And yes, I think it's true that there are many digital art forms that are finding their feet and evolving. I mean, even if you think about something like digital painting and new software is coming online all the time, or improvements are being made. But, you know, in the same way, you could sort of look at traditional painting and sort of look at new techniques and brushwork and new pigment technologies. So, I mean, you know, all sort of media forms evolve. I think where the big difference is when trying to sort of make any blanket statements about digital technologies is that there are so many different media forms and platforms and different things that we could be looking at. So we could be looking at, you know, 3D sculpture, we could be looking at virtual reality, we could be looking at games. You know, there are so many different forms. It's not really a singular medium that we're talking about.
What forms of digital art then really interest you? I mean, when you look around at that scope of digital art, as you say, where is the excitement for you?
For me, one of the most exciting areas is people who are using the internet as source material, so using things that they're finding online and actually using those things to create artworks and media. So there's a whole range of things. One example would be a really interesting German artist, Julius Popp, who's got a work called Bitfall, which is down at Mona in Tasmania, which some people might have seen. And what he does is he actually has a large sculptural machine in the gallery, but he's drawing information from the internet, from news feeds and different words, and those words are then waterfall down, you know, as water over viewers who are standing in front of the machine. So there's that really beautiful link between what's going on in the online virtual infosphere and what the gallery is seeing is a much more engaging, immersive experience in the actual gallery.
So the idea that there is no original physical artifact with digital art, with many forms of digital art, isn't necessarily true, is it? Because as you say, you can have that linkage between the physical and the digital.
You can, although I guess you could argue in that case that that machine can be recreated and put anywhere. Nevertheless, I think what's often the case with the audience experience of digital works is, although the work may be able to be duplicated and shown in other areas, what is unique and original is always that audience experience and engagement with the work, sort of, you know, in physical space or whether they're engaging with it online. So I think it starts to become meaningless with a lot of digital work to talk about originals, because it's like film, you know, it doesn't make sense to talk about an original print of the film where it's really the experience that the audience is having with that film in a cinema. It could be a cinema in Sydney or a cinema in Delhi. You know, there's not really one physical experience in that sense that's the original. And I think that's the same with digital artworks. And, you know, you can see that particularly with electronic music, you know, which is sort of, you know, created and copied. You know, there's not the one original performance in that sense that you might have with a violin performance.
How difficult has it been for traditional galleries and museums to come to terms with the rise of digital art? I know a lot of galleries talk about trying to have much more of a digital presence, but it sometimes feels as though they're talking about the PR marketing side of the digital world, not necessarily digital art itself.
Galleries have been really keen to take up social media in terms of how they're engaging with audiences, and I think they've been more interested in taking up that end of digital media in terms, you know, so for audience outreach and audience education, far more than they actually have really been interested in engaging with artists who are really using those technologies in their work. Often when I hear people from traditional institutions talking about new media, what they are really talking about is video art and video art installations, which has become an incredibly popular format. I mean, having said that, I mean, galleries, you know, some galleries are engaging. The Museum of Contemporary Art in Sydney had a great exhibition last year of an interactive game work by Joyce Interding and David Haynes. And, you know, there are a handful of examples, but this work can be quite challenging for venues. It's much more likely to break down than a traditional painting or sculpture. So there is resistance still to having that kind of work in galleries.
But you do still see a role, don't you, for the gallery, for, if you like, a central venue for the display of digital art?
I think for me, most of the art experiences with digital art that I have really valued have been ones that are in galleries. And I think the power of the gallery is that artists can display their work in far larger scales and create something that's a much more immersive installation. So, for example, one work that I really like, it's quite an old work now by Natalie Bookchin, where she actually sampled a whole lot of YouTube videos and created a multi-channel video installation where she sequenced similar sort of choreographed movements that users had put up on YouTube of them, you know, performing in their bedrooms and doing dance moves. And she just sifted through thousands and thousands of videos and sort of put together ones that were doing similar moves to sort of create this much more sort of interesting, engaging, large-scale piece than you could show, you know, just on one small screen. So although you can actually see a documentation version of that online, to actually see that across a number of screens in a gallery space, you know, it's far more satisfying for the viewer.
And satisfying for the artist, I would presume.
Yeah, absolutely. And like every artist I've worked with as a curator has always been really keen to present their work, usually in a larger scale format in the gallery. So, you know, maybe it's on a projected screen or on multiple screens.
Hi, I'm Monika Zagubelna, based in Poland. I'm a digital artist and I teach others how to start creating even if you don't believe you have a talent. I also occasionally work as concept artist and an illustrator. For me, it's like digital art is the same art like traditional art, just in different environment. So you can paint traditionally, you can paint digitally, you can draw traditionally, you can draw digitally. So this is the same kind of art, just using different tools, and the result comes a different format. So you can have it on paper or you can have it on screen, but it's still the same art for me.
The creative aspect, it all comes down to the creative aspect. Some traditional artists are thinking, oh, this will be easier, going to try it. And they come back on a weekend and the discussion will start up again about digital art versus the traditional tools. And then we have the situation where they can't draw. They can't do what they normally do. And they say, no, it's not easy. But I do believe a firm basis in traditional art makes a good digital artist.
Digital artists Georgiana Romanovna in Melbourne and Monika Zagrobelna in Poland. Now, both of them are digital painters. They use painting software instead of brushes to craft their artworks. Monika Zagrobelna again.
It's much more convenient because I don't need to buy all these tools, different brushes, different pigments. I can have all the colors. I don't need to wait for paint to dry. Yeah, I can save my work for later if I want to. I don't need to wait for good light because my screen is light. Not easier, but more convenient to use. Sometimes people think that it's like cheating. You can draw, erase, and until something looks right, and then you can pretend it looked right from the beginning. But it's not really like this. You still need to be able to draw. It's not like you turn on your computer and use a graphics tablet and suddenly your computer does it for you. It's not like using a command, computer, draw art, and it happens. But you still need to use your hand. You need to move your hand the same way you would move it when you would draw traditionally. This time you use just a graphic tablet, kind of digitizer, to bring your movement to digital environment. And that's the only difference. You still need to be able to create. You still need the skill of creation.
And as well as being an artist, you also teach people, don't you, how to use the digital tools to better their art, to create their art. Just tell us about that experience.
Yeah, I want to help people because digital art makes art more accessible. Everyone can do it. Traditional art is more about art galleries. It's like for a small group of privileged people that have some connections and know how to do it. But you just need a computer, small cheap tablet, and you can do it. You can upload your work. Art is something that can be learned. And if you want it, then why not try it? You can send your art to everyone. This creates a connection between artists in the world, and we can learn from each other. This is something, it's not very new, but it's growing.
Digital artist Monika Zagrobelna. You're listening to Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell, and today's theme is art and the connected future.
Hello there, new Deviant, and welcome to Deviant Art. Deviant Art is a wonderful world full of beauty, creativity, but most of all, community. Here you can browse through millions of pieces of artwork created by the Deviant
Art. Aiding accessibility and establishing artistic connections, both of those ambitions are the aim of this online digital art platform, Deviant Art. We met its founder and CEO, Angelo Satira, back at the beginning of this show. Now let's join him for a chat. Deviant Art, says Satira, is more than just an art portal. It's also an online art community.
Being new, DeviantArt must seem like a vast, frightening place full of strangers and foreign concepts that are too complex for your simple mind to comprehend. But don't worry, with the help of this video, you too can become a master of DeviantArt. Let's begin. There are two major.
It's a new thing, right? I mean, these are young notions, and DeviantArt was really the first to achieve this type of a vertically integrated, purposeful community. You sign up to DeviantArt, and you will essentially get a profile, a gallery, and a place to post your thoughts. And once you post your first piece of artwork, it goes into our newest feed, where people find it and expect that you are a newer artist and you need some feedback and you need to build a watch base of people who are nurturing and supporting you. And as you develop on the platform, you know, you build more notoriety, you build more popularity, and you have people kind of following you on your journey, your creative journey as an artist, and as you develop. And so there's many ways that splinters off, but in aggregate, you're looking at a global support infrastructure for artists to, you know, go through their creative journey no matter where it takes them. Artists will pick painting as a starting point, and they'll find that they prefer sculpture, they'll find that they prefer whatever they prefer, or that they like everything in the arts, and they're just a sort of Renaissance type mentality around these things. And no matter where you venture into, DeviantArt has a community of other like-minded people who specialize in that thing, and they'll help you and support you and nurture you out of the spirit of the love for the crafts or the arts that community is interested in.
Now, you've got millions of registered members. Could I get you to give us a bit of an idea of the broad sweep of that sort of art?
I would say that illustration and photography, I think, is a great answer to that. You know, I mean, literally the art form of photography tends to be very popular, but also various forms of illustration. Inside of illustration, you have everything. And, you know, there really isn't a skew. If there's a skew, it's a kind of global popularity of art form that's the skew. And right now in the world globally, you know, manga anime is the most popular form of illustration. But we're representative of that, and we're also representative of the other many forms of illustration that are, you know, way less popular or just a gradient less popular than that kind of stuff. So fandom, fan art in general is extremely popular on the internet, and DeviantArt certainly reflects that.
The deviant side of your site's name, DeviantArt, refers to deviation, doesn't it? To modification. And that was part of the original impetus, as I understand it, for creating the site back in 2000.
Yeah, it was about deviating your desktop. It was about wallpapers and what artists could do to make your computer look cool. And there was various ways that have become less popular now to do that. But the brand really connected with artists for whatever reason. And I think it connected because, you know, deviation is very much at the sort of heart of creativity. You know, thinking about things differently, putting into your artwork something that makes it shine or, you know, something that's unique. I mean, you're constantly trying to deviate even maybe from your own work. And we love celebrating those types of moments where people are doing something uniquely creative or have achieved a status or a state of being of deviousness, so to speak, where people have risen above and consistently done innovative, interesting things. So, yeah.
I read somewhere where one of your motivations was to get adults to reconnect with their artistic side. The idea, I suppose, that, you know, we stop drawing and painting and doing craft as we grow older. Could I get you to speak to that for me, please?
Sure. So our mission at DeviantArt is to entertain, inspire, and empower the artist in all of us. And our purpose is to nurture your creative nature. And it just so happens that adults are the ones that need the most help with this. You know, when you're young, you can't separate kids from their crayons, you know, and so the question is what happens? And there's all these wonderful TED Talks and various intellectual sort of articles about the value of increased creativity in people in general in a variety of different ways. And there's all this research that demonstrates that people are happier and better at things when they have some creative training. And so I really take that on as a very personal mission. It's really what keeps me glued to DeviantArt for 16 years. I started DeviantArt at 19. I'm now 35. And the very idea of bringing forward a platform that will bring creativity out of people and motivate people to be more creative in their day-to-day lives in and of itself, I think, is what excites me the most about being here.
Angelo Sotira there from DeviantArt. And Angelo has a prediction for us to end today's program. He predicts that the potential and reach of digital art is about to change, thanks to what are called digital art panels.
Obviously, you can put a JPEG, you know, an image on a television, and we do that with Apple TV all the time these days, you know, but there's an emerging market of digital art panels that are purchased and are specifically created to display art. And so the color tonality is being adjusted so they're not as bright, and they're framed, and you can mat them, and you can get them in different matting and framing colors and styles. And, you know, this gives you essentially wall space with an infinite gallery behind it that you can bring into your home and choose different curated collections. And maybe you have more than one of these panels, so maybe they're aware of each other. And sort of 10 companies so far that I've seen have built and begun to sell these digital panels at prices that are as low as $400. Think of it as the elegant, beautiful version of those cheesy photo frames that we saw become popular about a decade ago. You know, this is the substantially improved internet-connected appliance that handles art for your wall.
And what do you see as the implications of that kind of technology?
It's very exciting, and it's a very interesting trend in the arts to watch, because that really has the potential to take internet art, so to speak, and bring it into its rightful place, which is essentially on a wall in an artistic context, whether that's in coffee shops or businesses or homes or hotels. And this is very exciting for artists to have this new kind of canvas to decorate the world with. You know, previously we were taking digital art, and DeviantArt has a prints program, and you can print art from DeviantArt. But, you know, it's really nice to think that you can have a rotating art gallery, and that your friends and famous curators and other artists can actually create those collections for you, or you can create those collections. But at the base of it, it could be the beginning of a true marketplace for the sale of digital artwork. And that actually needs a lot of innovation before it can be true. But, you know, if you look at the example of the iPod and what it did to music and the emergence of, you know, iTunes Music Store, maybe that opportunity is available in the arts. And to me, that's a really interesting, more recent development in the space.
And yet another gadget to put on your birthday wish list, the digital art panel. Angelo Sotira there. And of course, if they really do catch on as a way to feature digital art, that opens up a whole new question about the future of the gallery. We also heard on today's program from digital artists Georgiana Romanovna in Melbourne and Monika Zagrobelna in Poland, as well as New York art critic Ben Davis and the University of Sydney's Dr. Kathy Cleland. Next week on Future Tense, intelligent plants. Have we underestimated just how clever they actually are? We'll meet the scientists and researchers who believe that plants can in fact communicate, sending chemical signals to each other for all sorts of reasons. That's reassessing our leafy green companions. And if you want to get in touch with us here at Future Tense, simply drop us a tweet. At @RNFutureTense is our handle. All one word. Thanks to the production team, sound engineer Steve Fieldhouse and co-producer Karin Savanovitz. That's all for another week. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.